Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Of course, there's some thought whose school is it anyway? Because although the name of my book is Which School, that isn't really the first question that comes to mind in any examination of how schools work. I'd rather ask whose school, as in for whose benefit do schools exist? Because from that question comes the more fruitful debate on the actual purpose of formal education. It's worthwhile asking why we even have schools in the first place. Why is it that most cultures have collected their young in groups to be taught by wise elders? The general purpose of any education comes from a never-ending contract between generations, an understanding that started long before any formal methods of instruction, and is one that spreads across all cultures and all civilizations. This is the recognition that each generation of humanity is responsible for ensuring that the next generation receives both a body of knowledge and intellectual tools to enable it to reason. Over the centuries, different civilizations have created many models for conveying that essential body of knowledge, at least for elite males. But in the 19th century, in Western culture, there came a recognition that it was desirable for all children to have some degree of formal instruction in those institutions we call schools. But the nature of those schools and what kind of education children receive continues to be hotly debated. And I'd have to say that some aspects of the schools debate are positively archaic. The ideology expressed by some of the people who define themselves as progressive is so hostile to any ideas that do not fit into their particular temper or come from their club. It is like stepping into a time warp to relive 19th century sectarian debates that I thought were all done and dusted. Most people seem to find it easy to argue about the funding of education on purely tribal grounds, without recognising the complexity and fluidity of the educational landscape and how this has affected and will continue to affect the way parents and students regard schools and teachers. The well-known tribes line up as public versus private, or more accurately, state versus non-state. It's my team against yours, with the biggest, loudest gang of bullies winning the argument. Just like a game of football, with one side complaining that the ref hates their guts and the playing field isn't level. The reality is that the education game isn't based on football, it's golf. We're not on a muddy field, but in a mock 18th century English landscape garden, complete with hills, valleys and trees. Other than the fact that golf courses are more aesthetically pleasing than football fields, the essence of golf is that it is played by individuals, not teams. The hazards are great, and the unwary or unlucky can end up stuck in the sand trap or drowned. And who are these people who must tee off alone in the hope of making it through the 18th hole? They aren't governments, administrators, or teachers. They're not the church. They're not unions. Nor are their parents. They're children. We create schools for the benefit of the next generation, not the present one. That being so, the debate on education should not be reduced to cheap political shots about parents who honestly and sometimes fearfully search to make those choices on behalf of their children. Too many people leave school too young, disillusioned with formal learning, hating all in authority over them. They often have good reason for their fear and loathing. Sometimes it's bullying by fellow students, and sometimes it's bullying by teachers and principals. In addition, as most parents know, each child is different. Even within the same family, every child has different experiences and different needs. What follows from this is not rocket science. If children are different, then it follows they may benefit from going to different kinds of schools. A kind of tightly structured school where one child flourishes could well startle another. The most important thing I think you can say about the nature of schools and children is that one size does not fit all. Which is why my book is subtitled Beyond Public versus Private, because the needs of children come ahead of any ideology. What does matter is that parents look for the kind of school that responds to their own children's specific needs. This is certainly known to members of the state school lobby, that strange tribe of teachers, former teachers, and their extended families when they're looking at schools for their own children. That's why some of the most vehement advocates of state education, people who make a career out of sneering at parents who send their children to private schools, make sure that their own children go to the best equipped state schools in the leafiest of suburbs, often with a harbour view. Those are the schools whose parents can afford to pay for supplementary teachers and extra equipment, the private school you have while staying pure and public. There's nothing like the rich stench of hypocrisy in an ideological debate. With the ongoing well-established drift away from state schools, some schools in New South Wales, especially those in middle-class areas, are dressing in the apparent gloss of what others think are private school clothes. So we have the constant propaganda of soft-focused marketing campaigns, the aggressive trumpeting of achievements, the increasingly frenetic attempts to control the narrative on the nature of school education. Yet the advocates for state schools are missing the one strategic advantage that private schools actually have: the size of the administration and the ability to deal with the person at the top. My belief in small operational units comes from my observation of arts organisations, and that's because my professional background is in arts administration. Any administrative unit that operates on a human scale with a clearly defined clientele is more easily responsive than a large hierarchical corporation. The one single advantage independent schools have over the overlarge centralised state system is that they are discrete entities. The administration is an easily identified chain of command. Parents and children know where to go if they have a problem. Each school employs its own staff and is also free to foster the professional development of their staff and promote them when they excel. It is far easier for these schools to achieve a continuity and a sense of community than schools which are a relatively powerless subset of a large department with a sludge of middle management. Size does matter. I'm not suggesting that no private schools have problems or that all state schools are modelists of styleless imperfection. But when there are problems in a non-systemic school, it is easier to discover lines of communication. I should here point out the bleeding obvious. There is no necessary connection between state-provided education and large self-referential bureaucracies. Indeed, New Zealand, only a stone's throw across the Tasman, has schools with the kind of autonomy that would be regarded as total heresy in New South Wales. State schools in New Zealand not only directly employ teachers, but are controlled by boards of trustees dominated by parents and community members. Their teachers are encouraged to see themselves in partnership with parents for the benefit of children. So why is the Australian bureaucratic system so different? And why is the tribe of the state education bureaucracy so utterly defensive of their territory? When I was researching my book, and I should point out it's 28,000 words, but the first draft was 55,000, and all those beautiful statistics, some were ditched in the final cull, I uncovered the different histories of Australia's government education by bureaucracies and those of similar countries. Elsewhere, public education systems tend to be run by county or local government authorities. Australian education systems were always based on the sparsely populated six states. Indeed, the New South Wales Department of Education is one of the largest individual education bureaucracies anywhere and is proud of this. To be fair, in recent years there have been attempts to break it down into digestible bites, and the campaign by school principals to have some say over staff coming into their schools is at last bearing fruit, but the cultural legacy of the monolithic state is still dominant. There is a particular conformist mindset, an ease with which the problems can be fobbed off in any large bureaucracy that makes it hard for small people, outsiders like parents and children, without kinship connections. Australia, of course, does share some common education legacies with the rest of the Anglosphere. One of these is that early childhood education is not as highly regarded as high school, or indeed university. In the 19th century, hapless pupil teachers, bright, compliant schoolgirls were given the job of teaching the little ones. They were paid less than real teachers. If they were good enough, they were rewarded with a short stint at teachers' training college. Even in the 1920s, it was possible for a girl to get a teachers' training scholarship without completing high school. And of course, two-year trained primary teachers were the norm until the late 1960s. It's an interesting status we used to give to student teachers. They were treated as apprentices rather than students and paid apprentice wages. So school teaching was a trade. And seen in that light, it was a fair deal. The state systems took bright working class kids and gave them an education in return for their bonded labour. By the 1930s, when the Great Depression encouraged otherwise unemployed children to stay at school, all teacher trainees had at least completed high school. Some of the people who later became this country's educated elite were given their start this way, including, I should point out, Bernard Smith, the great Australian art historian, hence the link to my field of study. The system of bonded scholarships for teachers was expanded after World War II, when education became our national priority. Most of those who received these scholarships, including the scholarships that sent them to university, were the first members of their family to undertake tertiary study. They were enthusiastic about the benefits given them by this project and so encouraged other bright students to follow in their footsteps. These teachers, who had themselves been helped to an education, assisted in creating the culture of mass education that so enriched this country in the mid-20th century. Now, I would argue that Australia is still feasting on the result of this investment by governments and communities, but there was a downside. Teaching in state schools with such an easy, narrow progression from compliant pupil to trainee and straight back into the classroom encouraged a narrow collectivism, a culture of self-righteousness and a belief in the supremacy of the tribe. This was exacerbated by another good idea. Because for many years there was no professional association for teachers, their union, the Australian Education Union, began to run professional support services. And again, this came about because the employers, the state governments, did not see the need to provide appropriate professional development. The result of this has been to foster a particular insular mindset within state schools, a mindset that sees only one pathway to success. There are, of course, other cultures at play within the education landscape. One of the most influential has been that of the Catholic parochial schools. For many years, Catholic school teaching was run by clergy. Nuns and brothers paid nothing more than their keep, dedicated to bring the Catholic underclass into mainstream Australia. And in this, they were spectacularly successful, even though sometimes you'd have to describe their methods as rough justice administered under high stress. But in the 1960s, with the winds of change in the church, many clergy left, even as the schools filled to overflowing, and there was a shortage of qualified teachers. Elite private schools, the schools that for many years had been able to ensure that their students matriculated to university because there was no competition, never had to worry too much about qualifications. Teaching attracted oddballs, sometimes brilliant, as well as those whose lifestyle fitted in with the school's ethos. And the best example of brilliant is probably Geelong Grammar, employing both the young Manning Clark during World War II, Ludwig Herschel Mack, a great Bauhaus artist. For many years, most private schools paid their staff significantly less than state schools, a situation which is certainly not the case now. Girls' schools were the principal employers of women university graduates, as we were hardly a country that gave many career opportunities for women. What was interesting here is that many of these educated women who became teachers were also, understandably, feminists, and they added the flavour of their faith in women to the girls they taught. For many years, you'd have to say that both the salaries paid to private schools and the general quality of teaching was less than that in state schools. In the last three decades, that has changed. So why? What I discovered when I researched was a tale of actions having unexpected consequences. In 1974, when tertiary education became free in this country, this was seen to be a good thing, in inverted commas, as in 1066 and all that. Suddenly, no more university fees. The barriers were down. At the same time, the baby boom was ending. And instead of being frantically short of teachers, as more and more children stayed at school, there was a glut. Some of the surplus was mopped up by casual teachers. But by the mid-1970s, there were more teachers than jobs. So when the Australian Education Union accelerated what I can only describe as an incredibly stupid campaign to eliminate bonded scholarships, the state governments couldn't believe their luck. Within a remarkably short time, the bonds were abolished, and so was the obligation to employ newly graduated teachers. So where did they go, those bright, young, rejected teachers? Many entered either the Catholic system or independent schools. Some, of course, did both. This cross-fertilisation of ideologies was a huge boost for the quality of education in this country. In these schools, the young teachers found traditions of pastoral care, of mutual responsibility, and in the independent schools in particular, administrative structures that were receptive to talent and prepared to reward it. It's not surprising that some of the best people in leadership positions today in independent schools, elite independent schools, were once unemployed state school teachers. Point that out to the Teachers Federation, they get very angry. They also brought an unexpected expectation that they will be paid reasonably well. And largely thanks to the Independent Education Union, which is the union for teachers in this sector, they eventually know that negotiated salary and conditions that are now superior to those in state schools. Always happens when you get... Meanwhile, by the late 1970s, state schools began what can only be described as a slow slide in working conditions, salaries and morale. There is research that shows the decline in admission scores into teacher education throughout the 1980s and 90s, and also how education degrees were spectacularly unsuccessful in adding quality to the students who attended them. But I would argue there's more to the story than this. Without those bright young teachers coming into staff rooms with their fresh approach, it was too easy for state hierarchies to become set in their ways, and no one was moving much up the food chain anyway. In this stagnant school, morale sank. The 1980s saw a further change in this country's educational priorities. Degrees in commercial law and finance, careers once sensibly mocked as only being suitable for nerds, were seen as more fun than teaching. By the 1980s, women had more career choices than any other time in human history. So it's no surprise that teachers discouraged their bright students from joining them in the staff room. When people and institutions are under threat, they tend to become defensive and insular. So some of the belligerent behaviour of state teachers and education authorities can be understood, although it's best described as counterproductive. There's another consequence of the education revolution of the mid-20th century. When we came to be parents in the 1980s and beyond, my generation had rather different expectations than our local state schools and our parents. So why was this? My parents didn't even have their intermediate certificates. They were children of the Great Depression and World War II. It was a heritage of underprivilege that I shared with all my classmates at Hurstville Primary. Working class people were aware of the disadvantages of their lack of formal education, so our parents were respectfully wary of teachers on the rare occasions they met. Yes, please. But I'm losing things. Somewhere down there, there are some more pages. But now, parents approach teachers as their intellectual equals, and this is not an unreasonable assumption. From my observation, many of the complaints by teachers about parents come down to a failure of that old hierarchical culture, which cannot accept that parents are no longer supplicants. Teachers now need to be as accountable and available as other professionals, and parents are often in the position of being their child's advocate. Those schools and systems which will not and cannot make this adjustment are not surprisingly losing students to those who can. Rather than getting bogged down in an unproductive brawl about private schools poaching students, it's probably time school administration started to reassess how to relate to their students and the families of students. Despite this huge shift in parents' educational levels, the system still finds it easy to brush aside their legitimate concerns. There is still a tendency to assume that education is something that happens to children rather than with them. So if schools are for the benefit of children, what we need to put into place are systems to encourage families and schools to work in partnership for the benefit of the child. This is hardly radical stuff. Indeed, it isn't that standard practice in New Zealand government schools. Bearing in mind that this is the culture that gave us circle sentencing as a way of resolving criminal activity, maybe we can learn from New Zealand in terms of education management. Most states now have different forms of parent and community representation, but many of these are confined to form rather than substance. The bureaucracy is usually able to ensure its own survival. That's what bureaucracies do. How then do parents and children cope when they have serious problems with their local school? Each state has different official procedures that pay some degree of lip service to complaints about schools. However, in New South Wales, as the recent case of Ben Cox's mother's long and heroic fight on her son's behalf against the Education Department shows, the bureaucracy will fight to bitter ends to avoid accepting responsibility. The classroom photograph, you might recall, for the five-year-old Cox, as published in the Sydney Morning Herald a few months ago, shows how badly the school dealt with the problem of bullying. Behind the group of five-year-olds was a message board with a poster saying, "If I hit a bully, it makes me a bully." That's a classic cop-out. It's typical of a system adept at blaming the victim. That child's mother was told bullying was good for him. Other parents and children have similar stories. The authorities, who have a duty of care for the child, tend to put responsibility back onto the victim because they can. Ben Cox's mother ultimately sued on her son's behalf, and the amount award stands as an indictment of the system that allows it. Incidentally, I recently had an apologist from the New South Wales Department of Education tell me that Cox's mother had to take her son's trauma to court because the Education Department believed in open government and would not hide behind a court settlement, unlike the hypocritical private schools. It's amazing what some spin can do, really, I'm sorry. So rather than running court cases, which do take money that ordinary people don't have, as well as causing unendurable stress to the children concerned, we'd all be better off if there was in our schools an open and transparent system of conflict resolution. The university sector where I work has undergone a social revolution as great as any in the last 50 years. In the middle of constantly being asked to do more with less, including achieve higher standards with fewer resources, we've also revolutionised our approach to students. When I was an undergraduate in the late 1960s, no one ever even saw a course outline. Our classes were small. My first tutorial, I'm so nostalgic about this, my first tutorial only had 9 students. And it was rare to see a lecturer outside of class. Now students are in constant contact by email. Course outlines are not only compulsory, but every single course outline at my university contains details of the grievance procedure, including the name and contact details of the school's grievance officer. Oddly, once this information became public, complaints were dramatically reduced. There's no reason why schools can't take a similar approach in informing students and parents of their rights. Some schools, notably those in the once-troubled Catholic system, have a very open policy on dealing with complaints. Other independent schools work hard to create a community with their parents. They are only too aware that if complaints are not dealt with in an open and equitable manner, parents will resort to a combination of legal action and damaging publicity. In addition to an open and transparent complaints process, university courses are assessed for student feedback. Teaching staff are expected to reconsider their approach to teaching in line with student needs. Now, one private school, Fed's Darlinghurst, is actually doing this. They regularly survey senior students on the quality of their teaching. The school doesn't assume that the students are necessarily right. Neither does the university necessarily assume that students who complain about courses are right. It's amazing how bitter failing students can be. But the students' opinions are taken into account. Listening to students is a part of the process of mutual respect. For years, there have been complaints on quality control in schools, and now governments are beginning to act. But they seem to have lost the notion of mutual respect along the way. Last year, the New South Wales Parliament passed the Education Legislation Amendment, in parentheses, Staff Bill, that enables the state to, inverted commas, let go of those teachers who chronically underperform. In recent months, the Minister for Education, Julie Bishop, has come out with tough talk on performance pay, where underperforming teachers will be financially penalised in an education free-for-all. This dog-eat-dog approach to teachers' rewards was reinforced in the federal budget, where a lucky few will be able to complete further professional development and be paid for it. Even the Prime Minister has put his 2 cents worth into the mix, declaring a fatwa on bullying. Now, bearing in mind that the first step to ending a culture of bullying is for those at the top to decline the use of coercive power, I very much doubt if anyone closely associated with federal policy has much chance of success. It's often underperforming teachers who benefit most from professional development, not hard guys. If governments were serious about supporting teacher quality, all teachers would be fully supported in paid professional development, and those who prove not capable of benefiting could then be let go. There will be less need for intensive remedial professional development of teachers in the first place if young teachers were properly supported in their studies and later in the early years of their careers. Some state systems have instituted half-hearted scholarships where students are paid a pittance while they study. Western Australia pays a generous allowance to farming year teaching students prepared to travel to rural and remote areas. But then Western Australia has rural and remote areas in a particular scale. The level of support offered to students in teaching is contrasted, I should point out, my son is a nursing student, I'm just finding all this out, with the funds lavished on those who join the ADF. The Department of Defence is currently offering university students in degrees like engineering and nursing a stipend of over $31,000 plus their HECS plus a generous allowance in return for their immortal souls. If it's good enough to properly support those being trained to fight, then it should be good enough to properly support those dedicated to ensuring that the country's worth fighting for. And I think that would be a revolution in education. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
And I should say that Janet Grundy, for the next chapter books, has got some copies of Which School Beyond Public, the Private versus Private, which Pluto Press recently published. And we had Tony Moore here from Pluto Press talking about Barry McKenzie from the Left of Humour about a month ago. So, question discussion, John.
John, thank you, Professor. Yes, you're right, critical was the highly bureaucratic New South Wales education system. I just want your comments on a possible alternative. For a number of years I chair of a private school. We didn't manage to figure it all out for ourselves without referring to anyone much too higher up in the school now after Rocky starts thriving. There was a system that was developed under Margaret Thatcher in England and I think Tony Blair eventually reversed. The schools, having worked out that 17% of the cost of education went into bureaucratic overhead, were given the option of taking that money, but they would have to run their own affairs as a school with that 17% plumbing and all the other things that the education bureaucracy used to do. Now, obviously not all schools could opt out and do that. Do you think, in line with what you said at the start, we should provide children with the education opportunities across a diverse range of schools, we could get that diverse range of schools if the schools that could do this had the opportunity to opt out?
I think there's also the other side of it, which is you have to look at needs-based. As you said, not all schools are equal on that. I'd really like to see more schools having greater autonomy, but at the same time, funding to be based very much on needs. I mean, it's a lot easier for people who live around Mossman to look after their sort of extra resources than it is for people who are seriously underprivileged. And so if you did that, at the same time you'd have to be putting in extra resources for those underprivileged areas. That doesn't mean it has to be centralised, because I don't know that there's any real financial gain in centralising things. I haven't noticed it.
Question
down
the back.
Yes,
David,
you raised the question of choice and the fact that schooling should be about the needs of students. Do you have any thoughts about how that kind of approach contrasts with a separate strand that's been evolving, which is the idea of single national curriculum? It seems to be extremely hard to develop an idea of there's a thing called choice about schools if ultimately the idea is there's one stylistic bureaucracy that's going to plan itself in Canberra that will decide we don't care how you run your school, as long as you all teach everyone exactly the same stuff.
I hate the idea of people being taught exactly the same stuff. There are some things you have to teach for certain directions. So if somebody wants to go to university to study physics, they're going to have physics up to a certain level. There's that level of competency, but you don't have to teach everybody exactly the same curriculum. And I just find the whole notion of one monolithic national curriculum quite scary.
Okay, there's a question here.
Yes, at a recent conference of principals, my daughter is a principal, was told that students from Comfrey, New South Wales, are so poor doing their education degrees that the schools don't want them in. They're too much work. And my daughter's had this experience in primary school where she has to correct the spelling of the teacher because he's marking correct spelling wrong. I mean, spelling's a minor matter. But
it's not a minor
matter. I can't spell, but at least I know that I can't, so I would just wonder, you know, we've got a way of sort of doing an arts degree, then doing some education. I wonder a science degree. Maybe it's better if you just know something before we learn how to teach someone else.
Oh, I tend to think teaching should be seen as a career for grown-ups. That's another problem that you have when you have this sort of never-ending culture. A lot of the problems that evolved in schools happened in the teacher education colleges in the 1980s. And that's another issue altogether. I do address it a bit in the book, but I had to cut things out.
So before we go to the next question, I know Tony Moore no doubt rang you up and asked you, but why did you write the book? What was the aim of a book of 100 pages which can be read quickly? It's a good read. Why did you feel a need to do that?
This all comes back to a conversation I had with Julianne Schultz ages ago. I was writing an essay for Griffith Review on concepts of family, and in particular my research on Richard and Pat Larter, but also something I'd written for New Matilda on something that happened to my mother, so it became a fairly large essay for Griffith Review. While I was talking to Julianne, we talked about our children, and I said, how weird that somebody like me, who's grown up in Fibrohausen, Hurstville, whose parents hadn't got their intermediate certificates, should end up sending three of my four children to elite private schools. And I talked to her about what happened to my eldest daughter at Stanmore Public, which was a total disaster, and basically scared Darlinghurst sort of literacy by taking her out of every class in Year 7, and she graduated from university. So that turned into an essay for Griffith Review, and then it was picked up by the Herald, and then Tony dragged me out for coffee, and twisted my arm. And one of the reasons why Tony did that is that his son had recently changed schools from a local state school to Newington for fairly, not quite similar reasons, but related reasons, as in utterly miserable, not working, not fitting in, not learning, and then moving to a school that changed his life. So out of that came that conversation. What kind of school is the best school? Is the best school for any child? Tony was editing this series for Pluto, and he asked me to do it. That's how it happened.
And your message is?
Every child is different. and for parents to be vigilant, and that really all schools have to have a transparent process for enabling dialogue and complaints and being responsive. In the end, with Stanmore, what happened? I finally got Lucy diagnosed. Very common form of dyslexia, enormously common form of dyslexia in our work in an art school. So many artists have it. And I remember thumping down this huge pile of reports on the principal's desk and saying, now will you bloody well listen to me? And she didn't. So I changed school.
So it all sounds pretty benign. Then why did you upset so many people with writing this book? I mean,
everybody's tribal.
Tell us who you've upset.
Well, you mean starting with a lot of the people who write things for New Matilda, which is always good fun. It's always nice having a stash. Chris Bonner from the Principals Association wrote me this absolutely strident letter with this wonderful piece of turgid prose, which I quoted in the book, when I had my article in the Herald, and we're sort of having an ongoing, interesting dialogue.
Having been a teacher a long time ago, having gone through that terribly impoverished Catholic school system even longer ago, having taught in high schools a long time ago and then more recently in private schools, but having left it all a long time ago, it seems to me that what's happened is that where once upon a time not terribly well educated teachers in Catholic schools taught a community that was even less well educated. Mm. And people looked up to their teachers and bonded as a community, and however imperfect it was, there was a kind of goal and a belief in certain fundamentals. as the teaching profession has become diminished in terms of its status education-wise and its status financially and even the respect that's been given to it, the parent community has become even better educated. So we've got a complete mishmash between the parent community and the teaching community. This can happen in private schools as well. I don't mean elite private schools.
Okay.
So where do we start? I mean, we started university perhaps, we started the culture coming from government departments, we started the Teachers Federation, maybe line them all up and shoot them. I mean, what there has to be. We've been talking about this for 30, 40 years now.
I think we have to renegotiate. We have to start take a look back and say, okay, it used to be the case that not very well-educated parents respected teachers because they were the people with the learning. Now we have to say, it's a bit like doctors. I mean, do you remember going to the doctor and thinking the doctor knew everything? That's a while ago. It's the same thing. The professions have to understand that they no longer automatically have that sort of cloak of power. That I'm lucky that before I was teaching at university, I taught adult education and I've done freelance writing. I never assumed my students should automatically respect me because I'm teaching. But some of my colleagues do, and they get very upset when they get questions. So I think those of us who are teaching have to accept that our students and our students' families have the right to question. So that it goes, it's a renegotiation of that pact. At the same time, I think it's about time society started valuing the profession of teaching. And if that profession starts being revalued and upgraded, I mean, it was a terrible thing that happened in the 1980s. So commercial lawyers, well, horrible thing, some of you probably are, but, or accountants, or, you know, people who are the kind of things that you did if you didn't have much imagination. Maybe it was LA law that changed it all, I don't know. There was certainly a shift that suddenly these old values that were really seen as important no longer started to be seen as important. So I think we need to start looking at what do people actually do, what jobs are important. It came as a real shock when I realised that the preschool kindergarten teachers who made my life possible when my children were babies were being paid less than the checkout chick at the supermarket. Mm-hmm. And, you know, what kind of society do we have that values people in that way? So maybe we need to also start revaluing what actual professions do, pay those professions accordingly, but also have high expectations of them.
Mm-hmm.
So, yes, teachers deserve that more money. Yes, we should expect more of them at the same time.
So there's a question here.
I enjoyed your talk very much because I'm reviewing for a publisher two books on education. You know. My question is related to the fact that you said the New Zealand system seems to be a little bit better than the Australian system. That's point one. Point two is the private versus the public school system. As you know, there is a lack of students going into the hard topics, you know, like science, physics, and chemistry. Would you say that the private system, as well as the New Zealand system, is a little bit better by the fact that more students go into science, or is there no statistical information?
I don't know of any statistical information on that. The interest to me of the New Zealand system is the way that they have set up so that each school is semi-autonomous, so that there is the right of the parents and community to be really involved, and the teachers and students and parents are encouraged to work together as a community. That is really important. That's one of the things that Anne was saying about the Hubble Catholic system. Where the Catholic system grew from. The math science thing comes back to that horrible question about if you don't pay people enormous sums of money to be maths teachers or science teachers, and then industry is crying out for them. I mean, again, I work for a university. I can tell you that Google poaches our best computer people. Google has recently taken the person who ran IT at the College of Fine Arts. He has gone to San Francisco. You know, they cruise through, they scoop us off. We're going to have a huge crisis. We're starting to have already a huge crisis in universities. Who's going to teach the next generation of maths teachers because they ain't there?
Yeah. One university.
Rory,
one university just dismissed 15 math teachers.
Okay, Rory Robbins.
My question is there sufficient funding out there to provide a quality education for less school Australian kids? Is there real per capita funding depending up? Why do public schools do fundraising drives for computers? Why are they sort of the same providers?
I would have to say funding is about political will and it's about priorities. It was once the case that education was this country's main priority. That was when Robert Menzies was Prime Minister.
That's right.
A lot of these things come down to political will. It's not necessarily state versus private. It is. Does education matter? If it matters, people will find money for it. If it doesn't matter, they won't.
So there's a question there that will come over here. Yeah?
Professor, your background is in arts and art history, and you explained that you're a teacher but not in school. Mm. I wondered to what extent you argue you're qualified to talk about not even private schools, and also obviously you researched with the department, but have you done much recent research in public schools? Because it might surprise you that over 5 to 10 years we are a lot more autonomous or semi-autonomous, and a lot more parents contact us directly in an optimum way, then your talk tonight would appear to indicate to the audience.
Okay. My other background is I'm a parent of four, I actually started working on this while my twins were sitting for the HSC. Where I teach at university, a lot of my students are in fact themselves school teachers. I hear it. So that's the other. And then we have to say, who's entitled to join in a public debate? Remember that this Pluto series is not about a collection only of stats, although I did in fact do my research, but it is also very much an essay. And I don't think you're entitled to stifle anybody, any perspective. One of the big scandals has been the way that the Teachers Federation tends to run the line that only those people teaching in state schools are entitled to talk.
Question here? Yes.
You said that generally the pay or salary for teachers in private schools is now better than state schools. And some years ago we heard here from a headmistress who had recently been in America that the reverse had happened in America for a frightening reason, that because there was better security for teachers in private schooling in America, they were prepared to teach there at a lower salary than in the state system. Mm. Do you see anything like that fearful example happening here?
I have no idea. I think the reason why one of the reasons why private school teachers were able to be paid more was there's been increased government funding of private schools. But I must say, private school fees, as everybody, most people know, have gone way, way, way beyond the level of funding. And most of that money, interestingly enough, has gone to the teachers. So I'm not sure if where teachers go or where people choose to take their careers paths may well depend on the economy. That's sort of strange thing. None of us know its future. People in times, insecure times tend to go for security. People in secure times tend to go for adventure.
Joanne, see that education is very much on the agenda now, again, because Mr. Howard, Mr. Costello, Mr. Rudd, they're all talking about it. So what possibility is there then of further enriching the diet? Because it seems to me that in so many schools, children are born. And now, in one school I know, violins have been introduced right across the board to six-year-olds in year two. And this has changed the face of that primary school. Because suddenly the children can see that when this phase is through to year 12, they'll be sitting in the orchestras and jazz bands and all sorts of things, and everybody will be using it. Now, they haven't yet counted the cost of this, but it's just something that's happened in this school. Now, why can't this happen at the school I was at, for example, when I started 57 years ago as a teacher at Peter Munro High. Now, why can't we have music throughout? Why can't we? And the paucity of language, the impoverished attitude towards language study is scandalous in communities. So why can't we have money poured into this rather than in further trade options at senior level, which is the runs? That seems to me to be terribly boring, and it's a TAFE exercise anyway. But anyway.
I have no idea. Some schools are doing wonderful things with music. I should point out that one of the good stories of New South Wales over the years has been its art curriculum. So at a really strange time in the 1980s, when a whole lot of awful things are happening in teacher education colleges throughout the country, College of Fine Arts, or one of the Alexander Mackey, which is the ancestor of where I now teach, was really doing dramatically different things with the art curriculum. So one of the reasons why you have Art Express every year and David Jones and the Art Gallery travelling the country is the result of that enriched art curriculum. It's only when you go out of the state you realise that this is something that this particular state does very well.
Yes,
you mentioned that education should be increasingly child-centred. I guess not such a good word, but and also that funding should be needs-based. I think I read somewhere that in Denmark that in fact children can go to schools irrespective of their ability of their parents to pay, public or private, and based on either their educational or intellectual capability or the needs of that child. Well, is that something that you're suggesting, that with the diversity of schools and beyond public private, that whatever the school is, the child should match the school, not based on
The child should match the school. The children are more important than the hierarchies or the governments or whatever. And what I'm really looking at though is just that partnership. If we can start seeing our schools as partnerships rather than as something that's imposed on people, then I think that's the way. It's not such a radical thing. I mean, probably doesn't cost all that much money. I mean, properly funding education and properly funding teacher development and properly paying people for what they're worth and expecting them to do well, that would cost money. But having an attitudinal change that says it's a partnership and not an imposing thing, that's not very expensive.
Just as a final question, I'm one of those people who thinks that most trade union leaders are pretty able people. They're quite cluey, and yet, but I notice when I see the leaders of the Australian Education Union and their state counterparts on television, they look quite cluey and able people, and yet they seem to be defending the worst of their members and not the best of their members. I mean, how is it that the education unions have got into this kind of predicament where able and intelligent people seem to defend the indefensible rather than proclaim the rights of their very able members?
Well, I think it's legitimate to say that in terms of industrial matters, and for me one of the big problems with teachers' unions is that they seem to have mixed together their industrial and their professional matters. And that's because for many years the employers weren't really seriously interested in professional development. So what we need to do is tease out that mess, so that yes, then the unions can defend the industrial side and the professional people can defend the can increase the professional standard. And on the industrial side, it's really the job of the unions to look after all their members, right? It is really a part of the job of the union to look after somebody who's a dub, but then also you'd hope to get them out of it. But it's the job of a professional association to lift the standards of that profession. And it's the job of an employer to monitor standards. So you've got It's almost as though what we've got is one big mess where everybody's folded into everybody else. And if we could separate them out of it, sort of unmix the pudding, and I don't know how we can do that. But that to me is a central issue.
Maybe a new essay. Thank you. Thank you. I should apologise to everyone here who stumbled around in the dark and it's an electrical fault and we really have no control over it. We're hoping it'll be fixed by next time. But look, it was worth waiting for. I thought it was great talk by John Nicholson and made me think about a lot of things I never thought about before. A lot of this material comes out of your book. So best wishes for the success of which school.
Thanks for your paper tonight, and thanks for making us think, and thanks for being direct at Tom. It's great to see you. Thanks.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.